One, like to convene the May 28, 2013 session of the House Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee. We are convened. Good morning to everyone. Welcome. I want to take this opportunity to thank our guests who will be presenting this morning on forest cooperatives. And with that, I'm going to invite up Brett Brownscombe. And Brett, welcome. Thank you very much for appearing this morning. And if you could also give us just a little brief background to kind of ground all of us on forest cooperatives before you begin, I'd appreciate that.
Absolutely. Chair Witt, members of the committee, thank you. And for the record, Brett Brownscombe with the Governor's Office. So Chair Witt and committee, thank you for holding the hearing today. And we're here, we've assembled a panel based on outreach from Representative Witt's office, and the panel is intentionally here to discuss forest collaboration, forest collaboratives, and the efforts of forest collaboratives to increase the pace and scale of management on Oregon's dry side forest lands. And so we're talking about national forest that I'm trying to get this map up projected for you. There we go. Let's see how we can do full screen here. So trying to get this to be full screen, but anyway, once we get this up, what you're going to see here is I wanted to outline what we're talking about geographically. So we're talking about the band of national forest lands that go from roughly southwest Oregon on the Rogue Siskiyou and the dry fire-prone forest there up through the Fremont Wyneema and then diagonally northeast to the Wallow Whitman up near Joseph and Enterprise. And so what this slide depicts and what we'll get into, thanks, what we'll get into in more detail here, but I wanted to leave it up as a visual and then just allow the panel to speak to the place-based stories and experiences with forest collaboratives. It's that band that runs diagonally from southwest to northeast, and the colors on this map depict the different forest collaborative groups, different local community-based organizations that are working on breaking social gridlock around federal forest management and increasing the pace and scale of management to meet objectives around landscape resilience, mill infrastructure that has greatly declined here and is threatened to further decline if something isn't done, and then community health. So these are not the ONC lands. These groups are working on the national forest lands, primarily on the dry side fire-prone area of the state. And I think with that, I really want to just get this slide up and then respect the time of the panel and the committee, rather, and allow the panelists to get going. So thank you, and I'm happy to take any questions at the end.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Thanks.
Okay. All right. For our first panel, invited testimony, I'd like to welcome, please, Martin Goebel, Paul Harlan, Alan Unger, and Mark Stern, please. And again, we are most appreciative of everyone coming out this morning to offer your testimony. Thank you so much, and welcome to our committee. Please decide among yourselves the order in which you'll present.
I think I was the designated.
All right.
I'm going to be very brief. My name is Martin Goebel. I am the president, the founding president of Sustainable Northwest, that has worked for 19 years now on this very issue of solving rural forestry collaborative movement. I'd like to start by thanking you very much for inviting us, Representative Witt, and the panel, the committee. We are, I think, charged with describing to you what forest collaboratives are, where do they come from, how do they work, and finally tell you some stories of what some of the innovation that they are producing for rural Oregon and rural Oregon forests. So I'll start just by saying, what are forest collaboratives? I think it's very important to just describe that very, very briefly. And the way I would describe it most succinctly is that they are at the heart, at the crux. They are really a cornerstone of how we are making progress today on forest public forest land management. They bring together a diverse group of interests to find common ground and to build a common base of knowledge, economic, ecologic, and social, to move forward on forests, forest resilience, forest health, forest community health, and, of course, rebuilding the remaining forest industry that, as we all know, is holding on barely by a thread in eastern Oregon, which we desperately need to bring back so that we can continue to do this work over time. Where do they come from? Forest collaboratives started in the height of the timber wars back in the early 90s when we were all facing seemingly intractable conflict over how to move forward. And frankly, the conflict, and I would say the hubris among all interest groups, was prevailing and had us in a sort of deadlock with each other. It was all our way, whatever interest group you happen to represent, or the highway. And instead, we got nothing but fog-induced pileups and many companies and people plunging down the off-ramp. Our forests and forest communities suffered the most. That is, the rural communities that are at the front lines of our forests. The forests were, of course, in terribly bad shape. They still are, from high grading, clear cutting, overstocking, and neglect from the 80s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, and even before. And, of course, that was leading to the perfect storm, which was drought-induced and potential wildfire that is now, we call, stand-replacing fires that are, especially during drought conditions, really, really affecting our forests. And, of course, watershed and hydrological conditions, which are all about our water, have been impaired, and biodiversity has been terribly compromised. In this context, a few very, very courageous people said, we're not going to accept this status quo. And they came out and out of this seeming disaster decided to try to start calling in the various interest groups who were at war with each other to see if we could solve some of these problems and find common ground. It started with the Applegate Partnership in the lower left-hand corner of that map and has rapidly proceeded to northeastern Oregon and all across that map there. And there are many, many collaboratives in place now, and you're going to hear from them in just a few minutes. So how do they work? Collaboratives work on what we nicely call the zone of agreement. And sometimes that zone of agreement is very, very thin because we have had very different perspectives on what to do about our forests and our rural communities. But over time, that zone of agreement has grown and grown and grown, thankfully. The collaboratives practice communication, cooperation, and conflict resolution above all. They build local capacity. In fact, they build local leadership. And so through these efforts, a lot of innovation has emerged. There's technical innovation, social innovation, and even policy innovation. Three examples of policy innovations that have emerged from collaboratives are the Healthy Forest Restoration Act, the Stewardship Contracting Authorities, and their widespread use now across our public lands, and more recently, the Collaborative Forest Landscape Restoration Act, which now Oregon is a great beneficiary of. So strong collaboration with the Forest Service has taken out a lot of risk and a terrible amount of litigation time that used to prevail in our forests. And so we're really moving forward ever more quickly on larger and larger projects and benefiting more and more people and businesses. I want to just make a quick mention of the CFLRP, the Collaborative Forest Landscape Restoration Act. It is a landscape-level initiative that has launched nationally. 23 forests across the country have been beneficiaries of it. Each of them are to get somewhere between $5 and $10 million a year to do more and more of this kind of work, which is tremendous. Oregon is among three states with the most designations of CFLRPs. We have three of them, the Fremont-Wyneema, the Deschutes, and the Malheur National Forest, and we hope to have more in the future. And each of them is getting about $6 million a year to do more and more of this landscape landscape scale collaborative community-based forestry. At the moment, up until now, about $58 million have been invested in Oregon's forests through this mechanism, so just over $6.3 million per designation. Through all of this process, some 249 jobs have been created or maintained. 38,900 acres of hazardous fuels have been reduced. Now, that's just a drop in the bucket, of course. We need to do a lot more. And literally tens of thousands of board feet have been harvested from forests through this effort. So I'm here to tell you that community-based collaborative forestry is part of Oregon's DNA, or at least becoming part of Oregon's DNA, and I'm delighted that I've been part of this movement and my organization has been able to contribute to it. I think it's the way forward for Oregon, and I hope you'll invest in it.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Who's next?
I'll step up. My name is Alan Unger, Deschutes County Commissioner, and I also chair the Deschutes Collaborative Forest Project. I actually went back to Washington, D.C. when they determined the first 10 across the country and watched the committee work over a whole week. I sat there for 3 days watching them work. And the reason Oregon's forest is they chose between the 35 different projects across the country, Oregon's five projects, or Region 6 of Washington and Oregon, the Forest Service, came in the top 15 every time. Wow. Our forests are laden with fuel, they're dry, they just met all the qualifications of need to be fixed. Deschutes County is 80% federally owned. Half of that is federal forest, the other is BLM land. We have a dry pine forest. It takes us 100 years to grow a tree to maturity, where if it was Douglas County, that tree would grow in 60, and if it was Tillamook County, that tree would grow in 40. We have volcanic soils, low moisture, and a real short growing season. What really keeps me up at night is that I will see, like last summer, we had the Pole Creek fire, lightning induced, right in the middle between Sisters and Bend, a forest where I hear people talk about, oh yes, I was up there picnicking, hiking just last week, and it was a great loss. It was 26,000 acres. It was an area where if we would have had wind, if we would have had, if the weather wouldn't have been on our side, that fire would have burned right into the Bend watershed, and who knows where we could stop it. With as much fuel that's in the forests, fires get started. You can't put firefighters in there. They just spread. They pop, the trees do, and spread little bombs about a mile away from where the fire is, and you can't do anything about it. That fire could have been a 5,000 acre fire if they could have got in there and fought it. In fact, the work that the collaborative did is what really saved Sisters. Sisters was 6 hours. The subdivisions outside of Sisters were 6 hours from being evacuated. When the fire started, the sheriff put three-hour lines around the area where houses were, and if the fire was to cross that line, he figured that was the amount of time he needed to take to get that, to get those people out of harm's way, and to get the firefighters in there. But we used the area that we had treated around Sisters as that attack point to burn back into the fire, to really hold the line against the sister side. The collaborative, really, I'm really impressed. We have all sides coming to the table. We have good conversations, and what we do is we give the Forest Service a template of what we all can support as they move forward in their NEPA process. And with that, they have more certainty in how they can move forward with a NEPA project. NEPAs, you have to do everything. If you're going to put a toilet in the forest, you got to do a NEPA project, a NEPA study. And that's really where things are slowing down right now. If we could get more NEPA projects completed, this Pole Creek fire, we had 1-2 weeks from ready to let so that we could then start working in the forest, we could get more work done. We could get more logs to the mill. We could remove the fire fuel load, and we could help keep this forest that what I what what I want to see is, and what I tell them in the collaborative, is that we need to look to the future. We've been talking about the past way too long. We need to be looking at what we want. We want to have a forest that is healthy, that is based on science, that has gappy, patchy places where you've got thick areas for wildlife, but you got open areas like a pine forest is supposed to have, so that fires drop to the ground and they're fightable. So just in closing, without the collaborative, I don't think that we could really help support the mill, that we could move forward with the process we're working for to really get into our forest. Our next big project is West Bend. That's from Mount Bachelor to Bend and all that area in between where we snowmobile, where we cross-country ski, where Phil's Trail is with mountain biking. It's what you see when you get up in the morning when you're looking out to the west from Bend. Recreation is what our forest is all about. It used to be about logs to the mill, but more and more it's about bringing people to Central Oregon so that they can have a healthy recreational experience and support our economy.
Thank you very much.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Paul Harlan, Vice President, Resources for Collins Pine. I live in Lakeview, born and raised in Coos Bay, and a lifelong Oregonian. I'd throw that in. Here to representing Collins, but to talk about the Lakeview Collaborative, Lakeview Stewardship Group, which is the gray area in the center on the southern border. Lakeview is remote. It's like 93 miles to the first traffic light. It's not Bend. There's not a lot of mountain bikes. We're dependent on what's around us, and you'll see that I gave you a handout. Would like you to look at later. There's information that talks about how the collaborative came about. 1996, I walked into our sawmill in Paisley as a manager, and I announced to that group at 10 o'clock in the morning on Thursday that we were shutting that mill down due to a lack of federal timber. And you'll see in there the graphs that set that up and kind of what's happened since then. It set off basically for us to figure out locally, what are we going to do? We're dependent on our natural resources, and what are we going to do? And we had a gathering in 1998, brought a bunch of folks in, about 90-plus conservationists and environmentalists into the community, and basically said, what do we have in common? Not what can we disagree on, but what do we have in common that we can agree with and work on and going forward? And the packet basically will lay that out. That, I'm here to tell you, is not a concept someplace that Martin cooked up or something else. The reality is that in 2007, Collins invested $6.7 million in a small log mill to harvest timber off national forest ground locally off the Fremont National Forest. The grand opening was attended and celebrated by our conservation and environmental partners. Okay. That hasn't happened. Mills don't open, and normally conservationists aren't there celebrating the fact that it's going to cut federal timber. Next Monday, we have a $2 million retrofit of that new-to-us machine that will start up. It's down this month. We're investing another $2 million so we can do a better job of operating in those smaller logs as we go forward. That's a success that we're here to talk about. The collaboratives don't work everywhere. It takes a partnership put together locally to do it. You still legally have the ability to stop it, like it can happen any place in Southwest Oregon or any other place. So that doesn't change. But it has set up a trust amongst our group of going forward. We spent that $6.7 million on a new mill with nothing in hand other than the relationships we have with the community and with our conservation partners. I would dare anybody to do that in business and base it off federal supply. So the state has stepped forward to look at supporting these, and they have there is as was laid out by Brett, that they're now kind of all over the state. Some are working better than others, but I think the state the people of this state and this great state that we live in, we should be working on those federal lands and showing an interest in that. Whatever the state can do to show interest in this will pay off by encouraging others to get in. Everybody comes up here with a basket full of problems with the legislature. And collaborative helped to bring a solution. They're not asking for you to solve something they couldn't solve themselves. And it really is a win-win situation. It's not for every place in that. And I would encourage the state to look for ways to be able to encourage either financially, but certainly spiritually, helping the national forests as we go forward in the communities dependent on national forests. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good morning. I'm Mark Stern with the Nature Conservancy. I lead our forest conservation effort here in Oregon, and thank you for having all of us here this morning.
Absolutely.
As you heard, the forest collaboratives are across most of eastern Oregon. There's literally one or more for each of the national forests there and several down in southwest Oregon. And as we look at those, we see over 5 million acres of national forest land that are what we would call middle-aged or late-aged forest stands that are actually in need of forest treatments, of mechanical treatments to help bring them back into forest health. And as you look at those collaborative groups across the state, what we see is they have in common there is all of them are really coming together and looking for zones of agreement, looking for shared understanding, and building trust among themselves. And the other part that feeds that is the participation and engagement of ecology and forest scientists that can bring that understanding and inform the conversations that lead to that agreement that then come out the other end and lead to some of the treatments on the ground there. I was asked this morning to talk a little bit about the project down in Ashland called the Ashland Forest Resiliency Project, and it's described a little bit in the handout that I shared with you. Ashland, there's a 22,000 acre watershed, comes right down into the city of Ashland, into Lithia Park, and is the municipal water supply for the city. Under the Healthy Forest Restoration Act, which was identified as one of the policy innovations over the last decade, that was a legislation introduced by Representative Walden, it allowed for the opportunity that when the Forest Service initiated planning processes, as they did there, that the community had the opportunity to come forth and develop an alternative that the Forest Service would consider. So in this Ashland Forest Resiliency Project, the City of Ashland, through their City Council, initiated a public planning process that brought together the array of stakeholders and interest groups, and that group of people came together and developed an alternative that was submitted to the Forest Service. And per that agreement, the Forest Service looked at it and essentially adopted it, not 100%, but mostly as their preferred alternative to implement in that watershed there. And so from that evolved a stewardship contract, which was another form of policy innovation, which is essentially an agreement between the City of Ashland, the Forest Service, a local group down there, a workforce group called Lomakotze Restoration Project, and the Nature Conservancy. And through that partnership, we were able to take funds and put them on the ground there. And as the handout illustrates, we've had about 3,000 acres of treatment in that watershed. Includes about 400 acres of mechanical treatment, another 350 acres of helicopter treatment, all of which has netted about 2.2 billion board feet, which has gone to Murphy Timber there in White City. So one example, Paul, identifies Lakeview. If you got to go 93 miles to get to a stoplight, as one example of a community that's been able to embrace this collaborative forest stewardship. Ashland is another one, and you can catch the difference in the sort of the social components of those two communities. But it gives you sort of both ends of the spectrum where there is the opportunity for those communities to come together and support work that gets it on the ground. And so with that, I would leave if Ashland's one example of where investments there have led to outcomes on the ground. It's contributed to about 15 full-time equivalent jobs per quarter while that project's been going on, and having those jobs in the community, providing safety to the municipal watershed, as well as safety to the town of Ashland is important there, and a good investment for all of us. So that's the Ashland story that I was here to share with you, and appreciate your interest in this ongoing effort.
Thank you very much. I also want to recognize that most of you have traveled considerable distances to be here this morning. So in addition to your very fine testimony, I want to thank you for the efforts that you've made to be here. And with that, do we have any questions or comments for this panel? Representative Krieger.
I've been around this a while. Since, I guess, 72 in my own tree farm. And, when I was on the executive board of the American Tree Farm System, National Tree Farm, I've done all that stuff. Board of Forestry with Brad. We continue to hear, you talked about zone of agreement and treatment for disease, basically, and fire treatment, so we don't have that. But at some time when that's all done, you've got these millions and millions of acres of standing, valuable timber on forest land. Is it ever intended that at some point you go back in and harvest these 24 to 38, 40-inch trees, or that once you get them there, do they just stay there and that's forever not going to be touched? Because if you're doing it for that purpose, you might as well let it burn now.
Paul Herman with Collins. Our ground in California, Representative, is managed on an uneven age basis, and it's not national forest ground, but we do have 30 and 40 inch pine trees basically on every one of our 94,000 acres we have down there that we manage. Those are managed for growth and health of the stands and growth. On national forest, I think talking about the zone of influence and what we can agree with, right now we're agreeing that we need to get them healthy, number one. Number two, we're also recognizing the fact that given, even on our own ground, our own Collins ground in Oregon, that the components that we are not replacing, just like we're not replacing fossil fuels, is true old growth, not just large trees, but true old growth. That our zone of agreement is basically that we need to have that as those components out in the forest, national forest, out there for future generations that they're out there. That's something that we can't necessarily replace, and that we need to protect going forward. Our jobs in the forest products sector in that is, one, is getting it healthy, and then two, we'll be keeping it healthy, because as you know, the one thing that creates our problems, forest health-wise, is trees and things grow, and it's going to continue to do that. And so that's where the long-term maintenance of those in those healthier states is where we're going to be, number one. Number two, when we can come to an agreement that we're no longer worried about the last of the true old growth leaving, do we have enough? How much is enough? At that point, we'll have that discussion about, okay, so what about these larger trees? What about pine trees greater than 21 inches? Are there enough of those to go around? And do we have enough? So I don't know if that answers your question.
Please.
I think it partly does, but across the landscape, you know, you have high-risk sites, you have special sites we want to protect. I think everybody agrees to that. Riparian zones, all these type of things. But there's a certain amount of, I'm talking about the federal lands, not private lands, that would lend itself to some type of a forest management to produce jobs and revenue. And I think it's doable environmentally. But I don't see that being a focus point down the line. We're kind of talking about now, but people need to be looking 50, 60, 100 years beyond my time. You know, I'm 73 years old. I just got done planting 4,100 trees on my 10 acres. We took 469,000 feet off of 10 acres off the tree farm. So I took care of it for 42 years to be able to do that. And I can't see why we can't do it on the federal land. Not everywhere, because it doesn't all lend itself to forest management.
Just quickly, I think, like a lot of things, ricocheting off the guardrails, you know, when it's slick, and we bounced off the left guardrail and we bounced off the right guardrail, and we're trying to keep it in the middle of the road. And I think that conversation will come. Our collaborative has had those conversations, and Rick Brown, a conservation leader that's been with us, said, we'll have that conversation. We're just not going to have that quite yet. And I actually understand what he's saying is, you know, once we have a landscape with a lot more orange bark trees out there on a pine site, then we'll have that conversation. But they're not quite willing yet to go there, and I understand that.
Morgan, I'll just add very quickly, Representative Krieger, that in the Blue Mountains collaborative, called the Partnership, the Blue Mountains Partnership, Forest Partnership, we're already beginning to have that conversation ever so carefully. I think we're all, if you look at the arc of change, when our conservation colleagues wanted nothing done, and of course others wanted much more done, like you're suggesting, nothing was happening. And as we're now kind of in the ascendancy of that arc of change, and we're doing a lot that we wouldn't have done a few years ago. But even in some of these collaboratives, our conservation colleagues are beginning to understand the economics of this, something that they did not want to even go to a few years ago. They now are beginning to understand that maybe taking out a 21-inch tree or higher, maybe, makes a restoration project economically viable. And economic viability is beginning to come into their language. As we do that, you're going to see, I think, over time, a lot more comfort with the idea of restoring forests and eventually managing them actively, as long as certain tenets are observed. And we're all realizing and coming to agreement on what those tenets are. So I think, I don't want to sound Pollyannish about this, but I think eventually we'll get to exactly what you're suggesting.
Vice Chair Escarill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I see is that we have probably more trees today than we did in 1900. But I see that we have a very, very diseased and sick forest. I believe that it used to be you'd have 50 to 80 trees per acre, and today you have as many as 500 per acre, which means the ecosystem itself has changed. And it also means that we're very susceptible to fire. We had the Biscuit Fire in my area, and that was larger than the state of Rhode Island. Yet we didn't salvage anything virtually out of that whole situation. We just left it as is. Having said that, it's quite remarkable on how people talk about the carbon footprint, and yet the carbon footprint was 10 times greater because we let the timber rot instead of salvage it. I looked, and I just don't understand why we can't get on the same page. And what I mean by that is that we all agree that our forests are in need of attention. I don't think anyone disputes that. But why aren't we taking all the forest that has been logged in the last 120 years and have a harvest plan, a 120-year harvest plan, where you take care of that forest just like a crop? Oregon only has two renewable natural resources, water and timber. If we take care of the forest will take care of us. But yet we ignore that for some reason. I'll be honest with you, I don't put much credibility in the federal government with their management techniques. I've seen it in the past. I've been appalled by what I've seen. And to this day, I think we're paying for that lack of good management. Having said that, I would like to see the state of Oregon be the lead on this. I would like to see us being more involved with it. And that's for several reasons. I'd like to see that the management of the forest that has been cut in the last 120 years be turned over to the management of the state of Oregon for several reasons. First of all, I think we do a better job. And second of all, I think it would circumvent and stop some of these lawsuits that we get by environmental groups that get paid for by the federal government when they have a leg to stand on, whether it be out of 100 items, they may have one, but they still get reimbursed at taxpayer expense. Whereas in the state of Oregon, if you had the state management, you wouldn't have that in front of you. So I would like to see us do a collectively good effort and treat that more like a wheat crop than just at odds with one another about the ecosystem. I think we're quite capable of worrying about our riparian and our wetlands. I think we're good at set-asides. We're good at salmon restoration if we're given a chance. But, you know, when 50-some percent of the state is owned by the federal government and it's out of our control, I think that's most unfortunate for this state.
Thank you very much. Representative Whitsitt.
Thank you. I was wondering if we could discuss the lack of ability to salvage the burned areas in the Berry Point fire that are part of the Lakeview Stewardship Group. What's holding up the salvage since we have this group? Maybe somebody could discuss that.
Representative Whitsitt, is right off the bat the collaborative in Lakeview undertook. So now what? You know, what's in front of us on that? And, you know, you've been down there and seen the ground. The collaborative group came up with basically a set of, I'll call them screens, but don't get hung up on the east side screens. It's not east side screens. But basically said, okay, in the forest plan, can't operate power-driven machinery on sustained slopes over 35%. So anything steeper than 35% is out. The riparian areas are out. And we basically looked at, okay, let's apply these four or five criteria. Less than 35%, not within a riparian area. Also determined that it needed to be within 1,200 feet of a open road or an administrative road, so there wouldn't be any new roads being built into it. It's pretty well roaded anyway. And use that as a basically as a sieve to look at, okay, if you overlay that, so what is available to be salvaged? At the same time, the Forest Service has a want to keep the road systems open and not have stuff raining down and closing roads and ditches and creating problems. So they also looked at basically 100 feet from the edge of a road, anything that could reach that road of salvaging that as well. That's a proposal that is going forward that is now out in the EA for public comment. Given that I do not have the specifics on the acreages in the coverage, but I believe it's about 30 million feet that once you take that, and part of that has to do with the slopes, part of that has to do with just adding 50 or 60,000 acres in Oregon on the Fremont that it's not all timbered also. So anyway, it's come down to that, and that's the collaborative has agreed to, you know, that's what they said as the sieves, and that's how it came out. At the same time, on salvaging, for example, the Parish Cabin fire last year, which I actually saw start, I was coming back from Baker to back to our fire. They salvaged that this winter, but they only did a roadside salvage. They decided up there that they didn't even want to get off the roads past that, and so they did a roadside salvage, and it was just a couple of million feet that they did get successfully done this winter, but that's what they did. So that's kind of how it got down to where it's at. We don't know where that's going to end up as far as final decisions. It'll be a test of the collaborative, obviously, because there is some outside interest from this, but we have worked at our group of trying to educate some others and saying, okay, but look at what's not being done and the rest of that to try to come up with that. We still feel pretty positive that it will go forward this fall. There probably will be an appeal, but that doesn't necessarily mean a lawsuit. It probably just means some continued discussion. The other screen on that, which I didn't necessarily care for, but that's what happens when you have to make group decisions, is there's a 26-inch, no tree larger than 26-inch, in the general salvage area, but not next to a road. So that was another screen that the group set on that. Does that answer your question?
It does, and may I follow up? I was wondering, please, how long do we have before the timber's blued? Obviously, when we, you know, when people don't want to do this and drag it out, it destroys the timber, and I was wondering how many more months do we have before the salvage is going to be blued?
It already will start bluing today. We brought in 30 million feet off of our own ground this winter, and our timber, including what might have been dead to begin with, was 6 or 7% had blue in it. We're going to see that jump up considerably as the weather warms up. The sap is rising in those trees, even though they're dead. The first year, it actually still pulls sap, which is a perfect environment to grow blue stain fungus. It needs to be salvaged within about 18 months of the fire. So it's, we're starting to approach 12. It can go into next summer, but next summer it needs to be this fall and winter that needs to be done.
Thank you.
Vice Chair McEwen.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I am so appreciative of the conversation and the courage that it took to get to this point with people coming to the table and be willing to have these conversations. I guess I'm curious as to what you all think about the possibility of this model now that it has shown some success in keeping infrastructure in place and keeping some jobs in place on the east side. If at some point this would be replicable on the wet side, are there conversations beginning to occur as to how we could parlay this into the other part of the state where we grow those trees in 40 years instead of 100 years? I'd just like to know your thoughts on what's the next step in this process of forest collaboratives.
Chairman Witt and Representative McEwen.
And I'm just going to, it's McEwen, and you get a pass. It's fine. Thank you.
Okay. I think that it's the only path forward. You know, in federal forests, if we don't come together to have these kind of conversations to find a path moving forward we can all support, then we're back into court. So it's really incumbent upon us to really do that educational process as we come around and see which others' needs are. We have environmental people going down and doing tours through the mill so they can see the jobs, they can see the value of what the product gives us. And then we've got the timber people who are out in the forest with everybody as we do these surveys after we've done some treatment to see what the forest looks like so that we can start educating each other on the values that we all have. So I think it doesn't matter where you're at, if you don't really get everybody together and talk about the different values and look to the future instead of the past to what you want to see the forest look like, we're not going to address all the ecological issues and the other issues of our cities and our mills all being healthy, because Oregon is a resource state.
Yes, sir.
I was just going to add, and I think whether the conversation's on the east side or on the west side, part of what the collaborative efforts have really done is it's opened up the conversation. So the Forest Service or the BLM, which historically kind of announced they were going to do a plan and then kind of went into the closet, did a plan, and then came out with, you know, their answer, so to speak. And the collaborative process has really opened that up so that the federal agencies are listening to what the collaboratives have to say, gathering that input in up front, and then building their projects from there. And is the conversation harder on the west side? You know, absolutely. But I think the model from the east side, could be a template for the west side as well.
Thank you.
And I am assuming that the convener of the collaboratives is the Forest Service?
No, I'm wrong.
Mm-hmm. All right. Can you tell us a little bit about this?
Well, it's a little different in every community. Mm-hmm. In Lakeview, when Paul and I first met, for example, it was the county commissioner, or the county commission, invited us in because we had been working in Wallowa County on something similar and had heard that it was progressing, albeit very slowly. So in Wallowa County, it was also the county commissioner, Ben Boswell at the time, who invited us in to help out. But quickly, very, very quickly, it's a group of people that comes together voluntarily because they're tired of the conflict and want to change course, want to change the paradigm, if you will. So the leadership emerges together, usually called by either a county commissioner or, in some cases, it's a local citizen or a company. But as I said earlier, it's a sort of a leadership, an emerging leadership model where it's collaborative.
Okay. Yeah. And you have found the Forest Service to be cooperative?
Yes. I chair our collaborative, and the Forest Service is at the table. Our Forest Supervisor, John Allen, comes to our meetings, and I'm just learning how the Forest Service works. And you basically have decisions made at whatever level it is of concern. So having your supervisor come to make sure that all his troops know that this is the path to move forward is very helpful.
I might add very quickly that one of the issues with the Forest Service is that we have, just like we do in any of our communities, we have leaders and then we have non-leaders. And there are many wonderful leaders in the Forest Service and many that aren't stimulated or incentivized by this. So one of the things all of our collaborators are doing are talking about how we change Forest Service policy so that Forest Service line officers are incentivized to actively participate and, in fact, also lead collaboratives. So that's beginning to happen. So I think we're seeing an arc of change there as well.
Very good.
So, Chairman, I think the agency, just like the legislature, if you hand them the answer, they're okay with that. I mean, it still has to be within bounds, number one. Number two, you know, the question about whether it works on the west side and the rest of the stuff, it is a lot tougher on a moist forest than the rest of it. One of the things, in Lakeview, we were desperate. We didn't do it because I was running out of things to do and thought, that'd be kind of neat to do that. We were desperate. And I think when people are desperate, they put their guns down and they say, okay, what are we going to do here? You know, and it may not work in a place that's comfortable. Okay? And that just may be a fact that you have to deal with. In some places, it may not work just because people don't come to the table because they kind of don't need to, the rest of the thing. So I don't make things desperate to make them work. No.
Vice Chair Esquivel.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Real brief. You mentioned about input from people, and my stepdad, who was a log truck driver back in the 50s, 1957, told the Forest Service that he didn't think it would be such a good thing for them to do a lot of clear cutting. It should be used selectively. Well, it took them 50 years, but they finally realized what he was talking about was true. The other thing is, I'm curious, what's your small log mill? I ran a Raleigh system at one time with an 8 1/4 inch DBH for the average diameter.
The our small log mill that we currently have that's being remodeled right now runs a 5 to 9 inch on the small end side, and our timber is tapered quite a bit, so there could be 2 2.5 inches of taper and 16 feet in that. So the small log is a 9 inch. There's a picture of it, you know, being fed. It's fairly small. The modification will allow it to go up to a 14-inch on the small end, which just gives you more flexibility, you know, as far as doing that. So it
wind band?
Right now, it actually cants and curve saws.
Okay.
It basically, it figures out the shape, rotates it, makes a shape,
skin,
and then the saws cut it along that. The modified thing will allow sideboards to come off, still make the shape, and then cut on a curve saw.
It's going to a flatbed resaw?
Nope.
Horizontal?
No resaws.
None at all?
No resaws. The other thing in doing it, which is true, is we put the small log mill in. It doubled the capacity of the sawmill. Doubled it. We added one person, which is Gerald. Third picture. Gerald runs the mill from the log yard. Technology.
Absolutely. Gentlemen, thank you very, very much for your testimony. Truly appreciated. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
With that, I'd like to call up, please, Mike MacArthur, Ann Forrest Burns, and Brent Bruskin. And I would just ask that folks try and be brief because we do need to be out of here by 10 a.m.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mike MacArthur, Association of Oregon Counties, feel compelled to add a personal note here. I grew up in Monmouth, and remember when there was a sawmill on the outskirts of town on the way to Independence. And then I spent a summer working in the mill in Valsetts, which no longer exists, nor the community of Valsetts. But I just want to give you a little bit of context behind the collaborative work. In 2006 or so, Governor Kulongoski convened the Federal Forest Advisory Committee, and most of the stakeholders were there, including a couple county commissioners, Annabelle Jamarillo from Benton and Steve Grasty from Harney. They came forward with a set of recommendations about what could be done, some for state, some for national. Among the state recommendations were that the governor and the state legislature should assist the federal agencies in providing administrative, financial, and technical resources to local governments and collaborative partnerships to build trust and help identify scientifically informed and socially acceptable forest management projects to improve forest health. Also, local collaborative groups in cooperation with the federal agency should first assess forest health conditions and then plan projects at the landscape scale to address high priority needs. And collaborative groups should define and delineate the amount of older forests that should be conserved and reestablished to maintain ecological sustainability and resiliency as part of their landscape assessment. And also, that the governor and state legislature should create a federal forest land liaison program to support federal agency and local community efforts to improve forest health in federal lands. So in that regard, was begun an Oregon Solutions project. I've handed you the webpage handout. And the convener originally was Mike Carrier, of Governor's Kulongoski's Natural Resource Policy Advisor. The convener is now Brett Brownscombe from Governor Kitzhaber's. We've been meeting since 2009. And counties are one of the stakeholders at the table, as well as environmental groups, the timber industry, federal agencies, a number of anyone involved in the federal forest issues are at this table. And we've managed to wrestle with a number of interesting issues. One that came to us was from the Malheur a couple years ago. They said they had projects ready to go on the shelf, NEPA ready, but they didn't have the money to go mark the trees. And Governor Kitzhaber came up with $200,000 to help them get the project ready for sale. That project went forward. Jobs were created in mostly Grant County, but it was a huge success. And to that end, the group decided to convene an economic study, which has been completed. The study shows a return on investment of state dollars in federal forest projects of about 6-1. So we're trying to find a way to help the Forest Service. And this group, the Federal Forest Advisory Committee Implementation Work Group, continues to meet regularly, continues to deal with issues like NEPA, how to streamline it, how to get federal agencies able to do the work necessary to solve this problem. So I just want to add one more note. I just came back from Flagstaff, Arizona last week, where I was at a National Association of Counties meeting. They have four national forests contiguous. Almost contiguous, the largest ponderosa pine forest in the world. They don't have a mill left. They're trying to do stewardship without a mill. We don't want to get to that point. That's Thank right. you.
Exactly. Thank you very much.
Good morning. Thank you for having me this morning. I'm Ann Forrest Burns, and I'm the Vice President of the American Forest Resource Council.
Welcome.
We are a trade association regional. We represent mills in five states. Our members are dependent upon timber from public lands as a source of supply, and we represent nearly all of the mills in eastern Oregon that are currently struggling to survive. Most of them are at about 65% of capacity unless they're currently shut down. And I've been asked to talk to you for just a minute about how the state can help the forest collaboratives that you've been hearing about already this morning. Based on AFRC and our members' experience with Forest Service collaboratives, we believe there are things that the state can do to encourage those collaboratives and to basically raise the bar. There are some metrics of success that are already outlined, have been outlined by the governor's office in the implementation for a budget proposal. You will have before you later this week Senate Bill 357, which would call on the Board of Forestry to appoint an advisory committee that would assist you in making sure that any money that the state spends has a long-term benefit from your federal forests. And we would be happy to work with you, provide you with any information we can on the best way to go about that.
Thank you so very much. Thank you for your testimony, and thank you for your offer. Look forward to the opportunity of taking you up on that. Brett.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, I'll be very brief. Brett Brownscombe, Governor Kitzhaber's office, and I wanted to just, recognizing your time and potential desire for questions, just be really brief. This is, first, thank you, Chair, for the interest in the issue and for organizing this hearing, and thank you to all members of the committee for your interest in this issue. I think for those of us who are all collectively working on this together, there is a governor's proposed investment of $4 million, and this is part of Oregon Business Development Department's budget, Senate Bill 5233, that would support not necessarily just collaborative capacity, that's part of it, but support the increased pace and scale of work on the federal grounds. This stems from, and this includes the mill infrastructure, this includes the communities, and the environmental health of the forests. And so this stems from a conversation that came out rather urgently when Malheur Lumber announced its closure, potential closure, not too long ago. But it's much broader than Malheur Lumber, a number of mills and a lot of infrastructures in that similar situation. Based on that announcement, the collaborative stepped forward and said, look, we don't want the mill to close, including the environmental groups on that collaborative. We have identified pipeline, potential acreage that can more than double the amount of management that's happening on the forest at that time and get to the level of millions of board feet that's needed to sustain the mill and its vitality over time. So you have the conservation groups and the industry and the community coming together saying, we've got a solution. What we need is the means to get there, both Forest Service and there was a clear gap, which part of this budget investment would fill in moving forward. And so I think you've heard from a lot of panelists today, whether it be industry investing in with dollars like Collins has in this concept and putting its trust in it, or AFRC being very constructive on, okay, let's move forward. We're all on board with that, but let's see what the performance metrics are going to be. Or the conservation community saying, you know, we're not here just to talk about saving trees anymore. We're talking about active management that produces volume and also produces ecosystem health. So happy to say that it's moving and more than happy to, we discussed doing potentially a field tour in the future. And so if there's interest on this part of the committee, we would love to set it up for you. And this is a very important committee. Obviously, it's important on all issues, but it's important especially on this issue. And so thank you for your interest.
Thank you very, very much, each one of you. We heard repeatedly today that this is a pathway. I am convinced that it's a pathway. If the committee members are interested in going on a field trip during the interim, please let the vice chairs know, and we'll set something up on that. And if folks would like to sink their teeth into this a little more, I think it has great potential for our committee's work during the interim. And with that, I thank you all very, very much, and we are adjourned.
Thank you.
Good job, Brad.